Welcome to the 200th episode of The Other 50%, A Herstory of Hollywood. I'm Julie Harris Walker. This is the podcast where I talk to successful women in entertainment and hear their stories. If you would have told me while I was doing my first episode that I would get to 200 and that it would feel like about a minute went by, I never would have believed it. I want to thank everyone who has shared their stories with me, everyone who has supported this show, and everyone who has listened. It has meant so much. And as for the future of the show, I suppose I will just keep on doing it. It's about the most fun thing I have ever done. Please keep introducing me to interesting women, and I will keep sharing our conversations. For this very auspicious episode, I sat down with my friend, Saraswathi Balgam, also known as Bonnie. She is a writer, director, and creative producer with several award-winning shorts and documentaries to her credit. She is currently developing a slate of animation and live-action projects based on her original stories. Under the banner of her production company, Dancing Atoms, Bonnie is also overseeing several hand-picked projects conceived by creatives in the USA and India. Previously, Bonnie served as the head of creative management for DreamWorks Animation in Shanghai, where she championed Chinese storyboard artists to tell authentic Chinese stories designed for global audiences. Bonnie was also the executive director of Rhythm and Hues India, a multiple Academy Award-winning animation and VFX studio. She started the studios in Asia and managed the teams of artists and technicians that created the digital characters in Life of Pi, Snow White and the Huntsman, Night at the Museum, The Golden Compass, X-Men, and The Chronicles of Narnia. Bonnie is extremely passionate about supporting the artistic community. She's volunteered tirelessly and served as the president of ASIFA India and Women in Animation India for 10 years. Through her effort, she has become an indisputable icon in the history of Indian animation. You can find us at theother50percent.com for added features, photos, show notes, and the merchandise. You can also listen on Apple Podcasts and all the podcast places. Okay, here's my conversation with Bonnie. We recorded this earlier this year before the pandemic when we could still sit at my table and drink tea. Have a listen.
What do you do?
I am a creator.
Ah. How long have you been saying that?
I think I've been saying that all my life. Mm-hmm. But I think I've had the courage to say it out loud, I would say, the last few months.
Well done. I was just looking at what you're working on, and it's gorgeous and exciting and so creative, and everybody will see it. But let's go back to the beginning, because you have such an interesting work history. Okay, where are you from?
I was born in India in a very small village called Vijayanagaram, like Vijayanagaram. Mm-hmm. It's in Andhra Pradesh. It's a very, very sweet and a small village where I was born.
And then tell me a little bit about your father and how that kind of got you into the entertainment business.
My dad was a banker, you know, and he studied psychology. Mm-hmm. And he came from a very rich family, but that got poor very quickly because of bad business choices that their parents made.
But that's a bummer.
Yes. Stuff. It's all life. And then when he decided to get into banking, and we were really small, me and my brother Pavan, one fine day in 1983, he just came home and said, or 83, 84, he just said that he was quitting his job and making art and just wanted to go to Annecy and get the Indian animation stories, basically Indian stories that he was thinking of merging them with great stories and taking them to the West to show it to the world.
What did your mother say to this plan?
She is another crazy woman. She said, whatever you want to do, you only live once.
Wow.
So that's what I have in my presentation, two crazy parents and two cute children.
That picture was adorable. So he quit his job and he started making animated films?
Technically, yes. He sold my mom's jewelry to hire artists to make art and then buy a ticket to go to France for the first time ever in his life, leaving the country. And he went to Annecy with all his artwork and an artist to just show the world that India and Indian stories have to travel globally and that they were ready to be done. And back then in 84, I don't think there was a single animation school. There was not an animation art institute. Nobody was teaching 2D animation. Everything was being self-learned. And he just hired a bunch of people from art schools to come. And, you know, we converted our house into a little mini studio where people were just hired. Anybody that wanted to do it was just sitting in our house and mom would make them tea and breakfast. And, you know, people were just doing 2D animation. Me and my brother would go to school thinking, why aren't we doing this?
Yeah, that looks really fun. So was he successful doing that?
He tried very hard. You know, being an outsider and not being an artist and not coming from a film background or a film school and not having deep pockets, he was basically manipulated quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But I also think he didn't have the heart of a businessman. He was so creative and so open and so giving that really his goals and his ideas didn't take financial flight. Mm-hmm. So he struggled. He struggled quite a bit. And there were a couple of times when everything was coming together, where he then went back and reversed engineer everything, saying, okay, maybe we get schools from international schools to come and set up a franchise here. And maybe that's how I start the whole thing. And at every step that he tried to do, people tried to cut him out because they said, why do we need you when we can do it ourselves? Thanks for the idea, but you don't count. And every time there was a rejection or every time that there was someone who, it's like the fruit, like you're eating something like the cup and the lip, like the distance between it, like it would always come so close that things were going to happen this year. It was going to happen this minute. Mm-hmm. And then something terrible would happen that we didn't imagine. And that happened for a very, very long time. On many levels, whether it was with stories that he had written and somebody took it away, whether it was setting up a school that somebody decided that they'll do it on their own, whether it was a co-production deal from France that he would bring to India after working on it for 2 or 3 years, and then an Indian studio would say, we don't need you, and literally asked him to leave. And I just saw all of that growing up as a little girl, and I always said, this is weird, like, he's such a nice guy. Why aren't things working for him?
Yeah, that doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. And growing up, because of all of this, me and my brother Pavan couldn't go to school because he couldn't pay the tuition for school.
Mm-hmm. So then what did you do?
We did the best that we could. And at the age of 14 and 15, we just decided we have to work and do the best that we can to pay bills.
So what did you do?
So we started working. Thanks to Dad again, he put us in touch with a lot of people. And they said, oh my God, you guys are brilliant. You should come and, you know, like, do this with us or do that with us. And so my brother, who was really smart, is really smart, started.
What is making you emotional right now?
What's making me emotional is just, I think it's my mom. I don't know what she was thinking when we were all going through this, you know, like how strong she would have been in her mind and in her determination to support a crazy artist like my dad, and how hurt she must have been to see me and my brother not go to school.
Oh, I would have been livid.
Yeah.
Was she working then, or was she just keeping the home together?
No, she was just keeping the home together. She never chose to work. She was just there for us whenever we came back. But anyways, my brother started, you know, like he got a friend to invest $200 back then in India, and he bought a computer and he started doing 3D logos in the 1990s. Mm. And I wanted to make films, live action films, because I was so angry with animation and how it never helped my father realize his dreams. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to walk away from that zone and go do something else.
It's not just not fulfilling his dreams, but kind of stealing your childhood with it.
Yes, pretty much.
Rude.
Life.
Yeah.
But so I went on a movie set right after my 10th grade. And I said, I want to be a director of photography because I'm a visual storyteller and I want to do this really, really bad. And I went on a movie set in Chennai, someone that my dad had introduced me to. And I spent a whole week and I was like, awesome. I felt like the best ever.
Like, this is it.
This was magic. This was like everybody doing whatever they were doing. and, you know, like 200, 300 people on a shooting set, on a movie floor, and everything was coming to what we would see on screen. And I was like, this is brilliant. You know, the response. And I loved the response that I was getting and the response that everybody was getting from each other. And a week later, I went up to the DOP and I said, can I please be your intern? Because I really think this is where I want to be and this is where I see. And I was hardly 16 at that time. And he looked at me and said, I think you're great. I think you'll do fantastic, but I have a small problem. And I said, what? And he said, you're a woman. You're a girl, not even a woman. And you're too fragile and too vulnerable. And I can't guarantee your safety.
So
if anything bad was to happen, if anybody was to do anything inappropriate with you, you can't come to me and tell me about it because I'm already warning you that I can't support you on that.
Wow.
And I didn't know how to take that information and process it.
Like, did you know what he meant?
I think I kind of knew what he meant. He just said basically that stuff is going to happen or shitty stuff is going to happen.
It's going to be terrible and you're on your own.
Yeah. And that was basically that. And
did you say, okay, I'm going to do it anyway?
Mm-mm. I went home. I spoke to my mom and she started to cry. And she said, look, I've got enough that's happening.
Yeah.
I don't think I can take... I think I can't take more of this.
That's too much.
Yeah. So when you grow up and when you think you're strong enough to fight the world, you go do what you want to do. But at this point, you are under my care. So no.
So stay safe.
Yes.
Do something else.
So that led me to getting into a visual effects company in Chennai, back then Madras in India. And they were looking for anybody that would bring them work, you know, little work. Like back then it was just logos for a movie or like doing some very basic mundane work. And they hired me very easily and I got like, and I said, this is perfect in some way because the only way I can be safe and still be connected with the film industry was that the machines were more important than me. And so there was a security guard outside. So there was no way that anything bad was going to happen while I worked crazy as a little teenager in this office.
And what was your job there?
I don't even remember, but I think it might have been business development, like something to bring in work.
And so what did that lead to? How long did you do that?
I did that for a couple of months and very quickly a lot of people said, oh my God, that's great that you're doing that and come over here and do this and come over do that, come over here and do that. And some very, very famous filmmakers back then from the South started, you know, calling me and saying, can you do this little conversion for me? Can you do that digitally for me? And so me and my brother were like, yeah, my brother can do the 3D logo animation for you and I can take the tape. I can put it on this hard drive and I can rush it to Bombay where there was the only place that did conversion from digital to film, and then I would fly to Bombay and get that converted onto film and then bring it back right in time to be put right in front of the movie, and it just became that very quickly.
How did you know how to do that?
I did.
You just said yes and I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it was just that. And I think I have a very smart brother. He was, you know, again like my dad, he's super he knows how to fix things. We never had the education to learn any of this. We never had the money to go to proper film schools or go to engineering or IT schools. And so we just picked up, you know, we would break, you know, he would literally open up a computer and assemble it back just to see what was happening inside it rather than.
That's one way to learn it.
Yes. That's how we kind of learned. And of course, my dad and, you know, always saying, go explore, go do this, go learn that. And yeah. These were the days when there was no internet. There were no full, you know, like literally, how do you find out about something that is the latest technology that's in SIGGRAPH, right? Dad went to SIGGRAPH in 85.
This is bananas. Okay. So how long did you do that then?
I did that for a couple of years in Chennai, and then I got called to a relatively huge studio in Mumbai, Bombay, in 1996, I want to say. my real first full-time job.
Okay.
And this person called me and said, why don't you come and be the marketing head of this department? I was like, I think I was not even 20 at that time. People always thought of me like, you know, they always thought I was bigger or older. And I said, sure. And I didn't have a place to stay in Bombay, which is one of the most expensive places. And he said, oh, I'll give you a place to stay. You just have to commute. And I said, okay, that's fine. I can commute an hour and a half every day or 2 hours from this place that he had allowed me to stay while I was working at his studio. And literally 4 years from then, I was very popular in the visual effects side of bringing him a lot of work, bringing that.
So you
studio.
Made a name for yourself.
Yes.
So you got to know all the players doing that job, I would imagine.
In the Bollywood industry, yes. Mm-hmm. In you know, worked with some of the most talented people.
Isn't that really the biggest film industry in the world?
Yes, it is. It's the most amazing. It's the most, you know, there are a lot of stories about how things can go wrong, but I was very fortunate to be on the visual effects side. I was very protected, and every producer, director that I came in touch with helped me every single bit, in every single step, because they were respectful of what I was doing. And they knew how passionate I was, maybe to some extent, and how transparent I was with telling them that, yes, we can do this, and no, we can't do this. And I think that was something that I learned from my mother.
And that was early days of visual effects, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right, that's right.
So were you just learning it as the technology was developing?
Yes, pretty much so. Like, I think CMM Studios back then was the only studio that had, like, a flame, you know, mm-hmm. and like the big stuff, and everybody was like trying to say, oh, we want to create what Hollywood did on that project. Can you do that? And we're like, well, you don't have the budget for that. So how can we create that for you?
Yeah.
But like in 2000, there were a couple of people that sent an email from the studio called Rhythm and Hughes.
Mm-hmm. We've heard of them.
Yes. And they sent an email. Back then, we had a dial-up in our office in Bombay. And so even to open their website took 3 hours just to see who they were.
Oh, my gosh.
And so when they arrived, I was in charge. I was the manager there. And they said, oh, we'd like a tour of your office. We're thinking of expanding, you know, sending some work, outsourcing maybe. But we don't know. We're just here to do some conferences. So we said, we'll come and see your office. I said, sure, I'll give you a tour. And, you know, the tour happened. And then they asked me, what do you think? Should we send some work over? You seem to be a nice person, and we really like what you're doing with your studio, and you seem to have this. And I was like, and I heard their side of the story, which was all about caring for people, respecting people, and all of that. And I, having the transparency thing, I kind mm-hmm. of said, you know what? I don't think we're there yet. You know, we have a long way to go to produce that kind of quality that you're seeking, and I don't think we can do that.
What did they say to that?
And they disappeared. They disappeared, and a year later, I got a phone call from Richard Castaldo, who was back then the CFO of Rhythm and Hughes, and he said, I think we need you to run Rhythm and Hughes. And I was like, no, I want to go make my movies. I want to go direct. I want to go produce. That's where I'm going. You know, like that's, you know, I've come to that age where my mom said, you can go do what you want to do. Yeah. And yeah, I think I'm going to go do that. And he said, no, just 6 months. We just need you to just do this for 6 months.
Just for a minute.
Yeah, like 6 months, and we'll pay you really well. And, you know, go set up Rhythm. And technically, what they wanted me to incorporate Rhythm and Hughes mm-hmm. Legally in India.
In India, okay.
And so me and my brother, we became the owners on paper to incorporate Rhythm and Hughes in India. Wow. And something that was supposed to be a 6 months gig ended up being 12 years with Rhythm and Hughes.
So you really opened that office and mm-hmm. ramped it up and hired all the people and did all the things.
Yeah, again, as you already know, I barely finished school. I didn't go to college. I did my long distance education, which means that you prepare for your exams and you go write them when the time when they ask you to come and write the exams. So I never went to college. I never did any business management classes or schooling.
And now you're running a multinational company.
And they were like, no, run. And it was an Academy Award studio. It was not just a studio.
That's no joke.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. And so I had a follow-up phone call with John Hughes a month later or a week later. I don't remember now. And he said, how would you run it? And I said, I would run it my way. And he said, what is your way? And I said, my way is to keep it very small and not to expend any money and just get the right people in and then take it from there. And he said, perfect. Who's stopping you? Do it. And later on, I came to know that that's how John, Pauline, and Keith, the key founders of Rhythm, that's how they started. When they left Robert and Abel, they decided to rent a dentist's garage. And that's how they started Rhythm and Hughes, in a dentist's garage. And so it was so... I don't know, destiny, I don't know, fate, I don't know, timing.
Well, you were right up their alley.
Yeah,
You're speaking our language.
And I had never, till that point, ever come to the U.S., and I was hired over a phone call.
These aren't the people who came over and that you met?
No, these were the people that came over and met me, but the people that eventually hired me were not the people that had even met me in person. Hmm. So I give a lot of, you know, like, yeah.
Wow.
So I'd never been to the States before. So here I am running Rhythm and Hughes from my apartment in Mumbai, hiring people and doing it my way, which was just talking to people, bringing in the right technology people to see whether we can bring in the right match of culture, of someone who was open, someone who was flexible, someone who cared, someone who was passionate, and someone who I could trust. And it literally all boiled down, without me even thinking about any of these things that I'm able to vocalize today, it all boiled down to trust. And how someone who trusted me when they met me in India in 2000, and how that translated to me getting hired a year later again because of trust. And how I ended up working for them for 12 years just based on that one phone call.
Well, I think you gained a lot of trust by telling them the truth about what you couldn't do for them.
Yes, but you know, how many times do people take that chance? How many people in the world that know that that they have to believe in what the other person is saying? But anyways, something that started as something so small grew up from me being responsible for, you know, bringing in groceries for the office, for the employees, to being the head of HR, the head of finance, the head of technology, the head of production, the head of almost everything.
The COO.
Yes.
And so, by the time you left, how big was it?
We were over 1,600 people with all the companies. So Mumbai was about 250-ish, and then Hyderabad, which was another office that I set up, was also another 250, and Malaysia was about 200, and Kaohsiung, Taiwan, was about 50 or 60. And then Los Angeles at that point was, I would say, very close to 700 to 800 with the freelancers. And then we also had another office in Vancouver. So that was also quite big. I think it was about 100 people.
So at what point did you come here?
I came here in 2003.
Here being Los Angeles.
Yes, here being Los Angeles. And I've been in LA for give or take 17 years, 18 years now. But I always came to understand how to work with, you know, how to build trust, how to grow teams, what was missing here, what was missing there, and trying to understand the dynamics of fear of, like, our American jobs being taken away to another country. There were so many times I was put on the spot for taking away jobs, and every time I had to just tell them the only way that we'll survive is if we expand. And back then, nobody other than Prashant, who I worked with, also my husband, we both ran Rhythm and Hughes. So it's like, And then John believing that expanding and growing was the only way that visual effects business could survive. Looking at it from a business point of a view, cultural fit point of a view, and then working on some of these very high-end projects, you know, having to have the trust of clients to be able to send some of the most crucial shots. And what if something leaked? What if anything, right, you know, happened?
And you were working on big studio films?
Oh, yeah. Tenpole.
For example.
Oh my gosh, Daredevil, Ice Princess, you know, Scooby-Doo, Garfield, The Cat in the Hat, Lord of the Rings, Elf, Cabin in the Woods, X-Men, Garfield, Superman, Happy Feet,
Life of
Mar McDuke, Life of Pi,
all the things,
Golden Compass, Narnia, Moneyball, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Yogi Bear, Mr. Popper's Penguins. Yeah, I mean, gosh,
we're doing it.
Yeah, we were doing some of the most high-end work in the world, and we were the first studio to have ever been able to build this world-class studios across the globe, mm-hmm, and to bring out some of the best work. And I think it's really, really all going back to someone trusting and someone, you know, kind of delegating it correctly. And then the teams, then every single person that we hired in India, in Malaysia and in Taiwan, they all really wanted this,
yeah,
you know, and very, very fortunate to have worked with all these teams and the supervisors and the support staff here in LA, working a different shift to be able to impart the knowledge to have those dailies so that, you know, they're the overlap of time.
Yeah.
My gosh, we were working very hard, you know. But at the same time, we could see how much this was rewarding so many people that could probably never, ever be able to come to the States to find these kind of work, that they were able to work and get credits on all these movies.
Incredible.
Incredible. Yes.
Incredible. Incredible job. And that's, that all sounds very, like a very operational job, right? Mm-hmm. Running a business. How do you then transition into creator?
You know, I've always, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, I knew deep inside that I was a creator. But even operations was very rewarding at that point to see how much directly I affected people, mm-hmm, and how much directly they contributed to my growth today. You know, their demands, their requirements, their focus, their trials and triumphs, you know, and just everything that an artist needed, and especially Hollywood level kind of work, right? Mm-hmm. I think it contributed to my growth creatively. So it was, again, very fortunate, but very difficult to what I have done at Rhythm, is that they allowed me to direct my first short film, animated short film. And I said, look, I always wanted to make films. Can I just please go ahead and make more films? And they were like, okay, fine, go try doing this.
Now, are you writing on the side?
I wasn't. I had really no...
I knew what time.
I had no time. And also, to be very honest, I don't think I knew how to. I was scared. And I'm still scared of writing. Mm-hmm. Like the typical screenplay writing is not something that I am getting a hang of. But my writing is more conversational. So I will talk about something that's in my mind, and then we'll just sit down and then we'll start sketching, or I'll have a couple of artists kind of doing storyboards of what I've said, and then it eventually becomes a story.
Yeah.
So I put myself over there as a more visual storyteller. So yeah, I made a short film. I co-directed it at Rhythm, which was fantastic. And that's when I knew, like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah. What was that called?
It was called Fulwanti.
And what happened with that?
Nothing. We made it. It took forever because it was always during downtime. So, yeah, you know, like the artists were taken away on productions, and then they would, you know, there would be some other artists coming, and then there would be always a change of artists. So it was interesting to learn that, you know, and it was such a hard thing to break my own boundaries, that I, my own walls of saying, you don't know how to do it. You don't know how to do this. You've never done it. And then you're a woman, and then you're not even a creative person. You're a head of a studio. You're this and you're that. And, you know.
Is that the tape in your head, or is that what you're hearing from other people?
It was both. It was the tape in my head, and it was also what I would hear from people. And the more I heard from people, the more I wanted to break it. You know, mm-hmm. I think everyone that said something that I couldn't do was actually the most beneficial for me to be where I am today, is to say, damn, I'm going to show you I can do it. You
yes,
know?
I am.
It was hard. It was hard when, you know, you don't get the support that you think you deserve or that you'd want. And it was hard. So we went through in 2013, the same year that we won the Oscar for Life of Pi, mm-hmm. we went bankrupt.
How does that happen?
That happens because studios and our deal with the studios didn't protect us on many levels. Mm. And it was a very, very hard time. You know, when they extended the deadline of a particular movie by 6 months, that meant that you had to carry on that many people on that project, which was not.
And they're not paying for that time.
And they're not paying for that
time. Oh, well, that's impossible.
And so we ran into some very huge losses, and the only way was to declare bankruptcy. Mm. And I was on the bankruptcy table, as I call it, just going through how 25 years of Rhythm and Hues was just so easy for someone to walk in and say, oh, we're just giving this to anyone who would give us the money. You know, the studios were just literally auctioning us. And that experience kind of broke my heart, and, you know, and I said, oh my God, like, that's 12 years of my life and 25 plus years of the owners, John, Pauline, and Keith's life. And we were all walking away. I was just an employee, but we were all walking away, and nobody got a dollar out of that bankruptcy.
Oh my God.
And in that same week that we won the Oscars, we had to, you know, like, I cannot imagine the pain that everybody went through of letting go of some of their best talent. And these are Academy Award yeah. winning talent. You know, this is not just anybody. We're talking over 1,500 people that are capable of producing some of the most beautiful work, and some of the most, it's family by that time, you know, and it's super hard.
I'm sorry, I don't remember. Did someone buy it, or did they go out of business?
No, so someone else bought it and then decided to keep the same name because that name was so valuable. Mm-hmm. So then I had to go in and also do the proper handover, which was horrible.
Painful.
And very painful. So they had a huge party, and I had to go and, like,
yay,
you know, say, oh, great, you're buying us.
Wonderful.
You know, and at that point, I decided that it was time for me to leave, mm-hmm. and that I couldn't work with the next company, just because I just felt, okay, you know what? That ended 12 years-ish. That was it. Like, I Done. Need to step out. I need to face something else. So I did.
And what was that?
I've been trekking for 20 years since I've been...
Trekking?
Yeah, like into the mountains.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I go on treks. And in 2013, I just decided I was going to take some time off and just be with nature and spend some time reflecting on life. And that's when I decided that I'll make my first documentary. And I said, I'm going to do it all by myself.
Okay, tell us about this.
Nothing. It was just really the filmmaker in me that was always wanting to tell a story. And I said, I love the mountains, and I love the mountain life, and I love how simple things are. And I have a teacher who lives up in the mountains, something very spiritual that I've always been inclined to. And I wanted to tell a story that was very unusual about my teacher, who is a monk. And I said, oh, this is perfect. I have a subject that I love, and I'm going to put in time and energy to make this project.
And so you did.
I did.
What is
yeah.
it called?
It's called Sisya, S-I-S-Y-A, Sisya, and it means disciple.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought about us, or me, as someone who's constantly learning. at all levels in life, whether you're in finance, whether you're in management, whether you're in creative or
on the mountain.
You're constantly learning. And if you're open, you receive. If you trust, you receive. And so I just wanted to put all of those elements into the documentary. And after 4 years of working on it, I finally said, yeah, this is the story. And so what had started about a story about on my teacher turned into his disciple, who was a German girl who wanted to become a monk. And I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. You know, which I didn't see again as, you know, as I was so attached and so close to the subjects. And then someone had to point it out to me and say, you know what? Maybe you need to talk about this German girl who's left everything and who's sitting here in the mountains and she sees herself as a monk. And, you know, and I said, yeah, that's great. You know, this is the story. And so I, you know, with great support, putting in my financial money into it, and fantastic editor Shruti, and a group of people, we finished the film after 4 years, and it did really well at the Stuttgart International Film Festival, and it won the audience award.
Wonderful.
And €1,000.
€1,000
for all the 4 years of work. And I was oh my God, this is great, you know.
Can we see this film?
Yes.
Where?
I'm in the process of trying to see if a streaming service can maybe buy it. Mm. So as soon as it comes out, I'll be able to put it out.
Okay, let us know.
And then I'll let you know.
Okay, good.
But right now, it's still doing a few film festivals, so...
Oh, it's on the circuit right now?
Yeah.
Okay, so go see that. And then let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now.
So after Rhythm and Hues, I went to DreamWorks Animation, and they were very kind and very supportive and allowed me to be the creative voice that I wanted to be. And I was recruited here in LA, but asked to work out of the Shanghai office, which was called Oriental DreamWorks. And so I became the head of creative storyboard department and art department that I loved. So the challenges were very unique, and I wanted something new. You know, I already run four studios, and I kind of knew what I was doing, and now I wanted to learn more about storytelling and, you know, visual development, which was always something that I wanted to do. So over here, the responsibility was to work with some fantastic talent again that were in storyboard artists and art department artists, visual development, and see what ideas they had. And they were all Chinese artists. So it was like, I don't speak Chinese. So I had to adapt to a completely different culture.
Yeah. How did you do that?
It was hard. It was the hardest thing that I think I've ever faced. I'm a vegetarian, so living in Shanghai was very, very hard for the first 3 to 4 months, where you're trying to understand what kind of food you should eat, and, you know, stuff like that. But, like, also communication was impossible because they didn't speak English. So I always had to depend on my translator to convey the tone, to convey the emotion, to convey the, you know...
And every conversation.
Yes. Yeah. So there were like a handful of people that spoke English, and those who also spoke English, they were very shy to speak English because they thought that maybe they were saying the wrong thing. So it was very difficult.
Yeah.
But the team that I worked with was very, you know, very, very good, I must say. Like they were fantastic. And a year later after DreamWorks, I realized that I had to go do my own stuff.
Yeah.
And so the last 5 years since I left DreamWorks, I have been focusing on writing a lot of my own content, writing my stories, both in live action, because they're so much faster in creating versus doing something in animation or visual effects.
Takes forever.
And also you need a lot of people to create something very small.
Yeah.
So I just realized, you know what, let me juggle, you know, let me do both live action and keep animation alive. So last 5 years or 4.5 years, I've just been focused on writing some of the concepts that my dad left behind. So my dad passed away and it's been 12 years. Mm-hmm. So I work very closely with my brother to some extent.
And where's your brother?
My brother is a visual effects supervisor and he's in London. And he's pretty much doing what he wanted to do. Uh-huh. But we always connect and see what is it that we can do together, or how is it that we can honor our parents and their journey in the smallest, sweetest way that we can. So one of it is to just, you know, take some of my dad's ideas and bring them to life. So we're kind of making it more contemporary, making it more, making it to current requirements. Mm-hmm. But using some of the artwork that he had created, some of the stories he had written, some of the concepts and ideas that he had back then, 35 years ago.
I mean, isn't that something? Like it took a generation, really, to make his dream happen that you're working on now.
Yeah, I haven't made his dream come true yet. But
you just showed me your deck. You are going to. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a no-brainer. You're going to sell all of that stuff. And it's interesting to me that you're working in 12-year cycles. Do you put any meaning around that?
Yes.
Okay, tell me.
12 and 36. I think it'll be 36 pretty much this year, you know, because it'll be 12, 12, and 12.
What's the third 12?
That's when Dad started 36 years ago.
Ah, yes.
84. Okay. So it'll be 36 years.
So this is the year.
This is the year, yeah. I think. I don't know. But like, because you asked, there's this whole thing about in Indian, the way of thinking or the way of learning, they say that it takes 12 years for a person to go full circle. Hmm. So when you become a disciple or an apprentice to under a teacher, mostly in the spiritual discipline, they would observe you for 12 years to see if you understood the laws and the rules and the concepts in depth. And then you become the master of yourself. Hmm. So I feel like Rhythm was 12. Everything else has been whatever. But I feel like Dad's projects that he kind of came to start writing in 84, in 2020, it'll be 36 years. So yeah. I think that there is something to do with 12.
There's something to it. I wanted to ask you, not that you can put it in a sentence, but what were your main spiritual learnings from your teacher?
I met my teacher 20 years ago in the mountains when I was not looking for a teacher.
That's when the teacher appeared.
Yes. And from that moment till date, and I have two teachers, by the way, and both in the mountains in India, I think the most beautiful thing is just observing them and how sensitive they are to everything around them. From a snail that crosses in the dark night, they know that it's crossing, and they're aware of that crossing their path. And there's nothing egoistic about who they are. So I remember once in the night when, in the darkest of the night, when I was with my teacher, I was in such a rush to walk. And he said, "Watch out, there's a snail crossing." And I said, it was so dark that there was no way that I was paying attention, but he saw it from a distance. Hmm. And I was like, that's, you know, and every little small, every small thing that they do, it's not the big things, it's not the miracles, it's the discipline.
That's the mindfulness.
Yes, it's just being, it's just the discipline to do certain things at a certain time. Hmm. And I've never seen them sit down, shut their eyes and meditate. They're fully there for you. They're fully there for everybody. It's not about fees, it's not about money, it's not about any kind of a luxury, but it's just really about full love for everybody, no matter if you're good, no matter if you're bad, no matter if you're rich or you're poor. The last 20 years, just observing them every single day, I see that. And my teacher's name is Bhargagiri Baba, which literally means a huge cloud, rain cloud, mountain-like rain cloud, like mountain-like rain cloud. And that's what I see, like a giver, you know, constantly giving, whether it's shade, water, absorbing, giving. And he's just the sweetest soul. I And my other teacher, she's called Viveka Prana, which literally means life force knowledge.
Wow.
And she, I remember her, meeting her about 15, maybe 14 years ago. And in one of her first conversations in a group, she said, "Who told you life will be easy?" And I still think about it and I say, "Yeah, who told me that?" No, you know, it's, you know, it just puts life in a very different perspective.
Like, you have no evidence that life is supposed to be easy.
No, but also having that expectation makes you either weak or play the victim.
Yeah.
And so she always has this strength that she instills in me every time I even think about her is nothing but strength. Mm. And my other teacher is nothing but clarity. So it's always asking. So he would always say, "You have a mind, don't you?" And I would say, "Yes." And says, "Okay, that's very simple. Then all you have to do is think. Then you have to understand what you're thinking. And then you have to walk your path. It doesn't matter what that is." And he, in the last 20 years, that's the one thing that he's repeated all the time to me and to anyone that goes to him. And think, understand, and walk your path. And then the other one is just strength. Like, you got to have courage. Know you are the child of this universe, you know, and to go with that kind of a strength wherever you go. And then, of course, you know, my parents, who've been the most profound teachers of, like, you got to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. And my brother, again, is, you know, talking about teachers, I feel like I've been blessed. I've been super blessed with all of these fantastic people in my life. My brother is like the mountain of strength for me. You know, every time I go and try to tell him something is not working, he said, "Look around, stop cribbing, look around. There are so many more people that are in such a bad shape. You're not. So just come on. I'm not going to give you the sympathy that you need. You know, I'm not going to be that person. So get up and do what you got to do." And my husband, you know, I have not seen another wonderful soul that's there constantly supporting, you know, just saying, "You got to do it. And you know, when I decided I was going to quit my job and I said, "Can I do this?" He said, "Of course. Why are you even asking?" Mm. You know, he's very much like my mom in so many ways. Like, you got to do what you got to do. I support you no matter what. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And then the people at Rhythm and Hues, you know, I only give credit to a few, but almost everybody just standing there supporting and trusting a girl who's brown and short and doesn't know what the hell she has learned, but they're just simply trusting and saying, "All right, let's just trust her. Let's see what happens if we trust her." You know, so I think it's all of that.
All of that. What advice do you have for women coming up behind you?
I don't know if I can really say it's an advice. I think, just please don't distort yourself.
What do you mean by that?
I mean by that is there's always a negative voice in our heads that puts us, we distort ourselves, like, you know, the 10 cognitive distortions, and you can look it up online.
Okay.
But basically, I learned that very late, where I'm putting myself down all the time. Mm. I'm making myself smaller than everybody else. I'm comparing, or I'm minimizing who I am. And I don't think all women do that, but if anybody is doing
that,
I mean, again, it's a generation, like, you know, like 40 years ago, 20 years ago, today, I think we've changed, you know, things have changed, technology, people, the world has become very different. So always respect yourself is the only thing that I would say is, I think, self-love and self-respect. And then trust yourself. And if you make mistakes, celebrate them.
Nailed it.
Yes.
Okay, what's next for you? Are you out pitching your project?
Yeah. So I was very fortunate after 5 years of being unemployed, you know, like volunteer unemployment and just focusing on my own gigs.
Fun employment.
Yes, fun employment. That I'm paying myself. I was able to pitch some of those concepts to a streaming service here in LA, and can't name them yet. but they were very kind to have listened to my story more than anything else. And they saw something and they said, oh my God, this is nice. Let's try and do something with this.
Great.
And so I'm excited for the validation maybe I received that I am now a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say that louder than ever.
You can stand in that.
I can stand in that. I'm shining in that. I'm happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. You know, like I'm going in with very little expectations and just doing what I need to do and let things unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And doing the best that I can.
How can people find you?
I have a website called www.dancingatoms.com, so they can find me there.
Mm-hmm.
Write me an email and I can get back to them.
Okay. I think you are a bright and shiny light. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
You've been listening to The Other 50%, A Herstory of Hollywood. I'm Julie Harris Walker. I'd like to thank Saraswathi Balgam, my friend Vani, for sharing her story. And special thanks to Jay Rowe, Danny Rosner, and Alison McQuaid for the music. Please find us on your favorite podcast provider and leave a review. And of course, on our website, theother50percent.com, all spelled out in letters, for added features, bios of our guests, and the merch. You can also follow us on all the social media platforms. Thanks for listening. See you next time.